my pleasure and privilege to be with you tonight and appreciate the opportunity to speak on this topic. The issue we will discuss today is a difficult one, and I think there are three primary reasons for that difficulty. First, there is what we might call the embarrassment factor. There are certain problems that all would rather ignore than face. Pliny the Elder, in his treatise on wildlife, suggested that this was the practice of the ostrich to bury her head in the sand when confronted with danger she could not escape or handle. It has since been proven that ostriches don't really do that, but humans are another story. And as I read and researched for my topic, I was reminded of a line from Rodgers and Hammerstein's Showboat, where an African slave working on the Mississippi River sings a lamentation about his difficult life. And he says, "There's an old man called the Mississippi." That's the old man that I'd like to be, because what does he care if the world's got troubles, and what does he care if the land ain't free? He must think something, but he don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling along, and I can relate. Wouldn't life be wonderful if, when confronted with all the unpleasantness and injustice and trouble of the world, we could just roll along and just bury our heads in the sand? But alas, as Christians, we must understand we're not afforded that luxury. God has called his people to a life of honest examination of truth and righteousness, a life of concern for other people, a life where love for God and love for our neighbor molds and makes our every decision, according to Luke 10 and verse 27. But confronting the issue of racism is perhaps one of the most difficult times for us to live this way. It is so ugly. History is replete with tragic and terrible epics when people who look different than us or just like us were subjected to the most brutal and inhumane cruelties, in some cases treated worse than animals, just because they looked different than us or just like us. And if we look hard enough, we'll find that this has, in a terribly humiliating way, scarred our nation, our families, our brotherhood, and that perhaps it even has a place in our own hearts. But not only the embarrassment factor, there's also the emotion factor. For some years now, Christians have had a reason to ignore racism. It seems to be more of a social issue than a spiritual one. Since the 1960s, racism has been one of the most politically charged topics in America, and virtually all spectators see a biased and prejudicial treatment of the issue in the court of politics and media and academia. Civil rights and the politics of race relations is a battleground where racism is practiced from all directions, where flamboyant characters claim to be the victims of crimes committed centuries ago and try to hold modern men and women responsible for the actions of people who looked like them 200 years ago. And then actors and authors, comedians, musicians, artists, philosophers, and theologians join the fray, and all hope for logical discussion is drowned out in a chaotic, deafening roar of anger. It only serves to fan the flames of hate and widen the gulf of separation. And as I have read and listened to discussions on racism from the social platform, I was reminded of the riot in Ephesus, where the Bible says over in Acts 19 and verse 32, "Some therefore cried one thing and some another, and the assembly was confused, and most of them did not know why they had come together." And that brings us to the third problem. Not only the embarrassment and the emotion, but the confusion factor. What is the real issue here? What are we fighting? And what are we fighting for? We're going to see that this is a moral and spiritual issue, not merely social. And the only source for clarity and truth and practical counsel on how to rightly live and feel is the Word of God the Creator presented to us in the Bible. What is racism? By definition, a belief or doctrine that inherent differences among the various human races determine cultural or individual achievement, usually involving the idea that one's own race is superior and has the right to rule others. But that doesn't really explain the issue, does it? I mean, what is a race? And here the struggle for clarity begins. Biologically speaking, there are four basic human races: the Caucasoid, the Mongoloid, the Negroid, and the Australoid. In a population breakdown, the human world is made up of 55% Caucasoid, 33% Mongoloid, 8% Negroid, and 4% Australoid. And these races are distributed throughout the globe in over 100 nations and speak over 3,000 tribal languages and dialects. However, in spite of our constant references to race and the widespread use of the term, the lines are not at all clear dividing one race from another. Over 100 years ago, A.J. Toynbee of Oxford admitted that from a purely scientific approach, ethnologists find themselves identifying one man as belonging to one race in one respect and another race in another respect. And this is because the criteria for defining race is vast, varied, and unclear. Bert Thompson says, "No one has ever been able to suggest a truly reliable way to distinguish one race from another. Various factors considered include skin color, hair texture, facial features, skull proportions, teeth, brain size, body shape, even apocrine glands or body odor, metabolic rates, and earwax consistencies. But while there is certainly legitimate and noticeable variation in these areas, and in a sense it can be classified, none serve to draw clear lines of separation between different types or races of human. For instance, skin color, which varies from deep black to sandy yellow to reddish tan to creamy white to pale pink, is probably the most commonly used racial distinction. But this provides innumerable difficulties because while most Africans from south of the Sahara and their descendants around the world have skin that is darker than most Europeans, there are millions of people in India classified by many anthropologists as Caucasoids or Caucasians who have darker skin than most American blacks. Some Africans living in sub-Saharan regions have skin color that is no darker than some Spaniards or Greeks or Lebanese, while the Australoid race, Australian Aborigines, is considered by most ethnologists to be a subgroup of the Caucasoids, even though their skin is as dark as any Negroid. Stature has also frequently been used to mark racial distinctions, but this would mean that the dark-skinned African Watusis, who grow to be over 7 feet tall, are one and the same race as the tall, pale Scandinavians, and a different race from the short African pygmies, who only reach 5 feet. And nobody is willing to make that suggestion. Various appearance features have also been suggested as the criterion for race determination. For example, most people are familiar with the almond-shaped eye of Oriental persons. A little web of skin so characteristic of the Oriental eye is said to be the distinguishing factor of the Mongoloid race. Yet if one were to accept that argument, then how does he include the American Indian, who is classified as a Mongoloid and yet lacks the epicanthic fold? Such features as hair color, eye color, hair form, the shapes of noses and lips, and many other traits are set forth as markers of one race or another, but all too often are found distributed throughout many races. Among the tall people of the world, there are those who exhibit every skin color imaginable, from black to white and everything in between. Among black people in the world, there's some who possess kinky hair, some who possess straight hair, wavy hair, and again, many in between. Among the broad-nosed, full-lipped people of the world, there are many with dark skin, and there are many with light skin, and many in between. The complexity of the issue increases. The world is filled with populations that seem to defy classification. Consider some of these well-known examples. The Bushmen of southern Africa, who appear to be as much Mongoloid as Negroid. The Negritos of the South Pacific do look Negroid, but are far removed from Africa and have no known links to that continent. The Ainu people of northern Japan are a hairy Aboriginal traditional type of people with skin as white as any Caucasian, but eyes slanted as a mongoloid. The Aborigines of Australia sometimes look Negroid, but they often have straight or wavy hair and are occasionally blonde as children or, as in our picture, even adults. Because of this immense diversity spread throughout all the peoples of the earth, Dr. Toynbee, by no means a conservative or biblical scholar, said that there is a marked difference between genuine ethnological distinction and what he calls race feeling. In fact, he declares the commonly held distinctions of race to be, in his words, mythological. In his article in the Hastings Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics, he states that modern racism historically appeared only in the most primitive societies that did not understand why any abnormality or difference from the norm would exist and suspected demons or magic to be involved. Even the prejudice of the Hellenists in Greek, who called everybody else a barbarian by comparison, didn't really make racial distinctions like the one we've noticed. A Hellenist, as we'll notice later, was a Greek speaker, a free man, and a person who lived a Greek lifestyle in most respects. And anyone who conformed to that mold would receive the title regardless of his physical appearance. Lord James Bryce, in his Crichton lecture on race sentiments as a factor in history, surveyed the conditions in the ancient world, the Middle Ages, and modern times up to the French Revolution, arriving at the following conclusions, which he regards as broadly true. The survey of facts, he says, has shown us that down till the days of the French Revolution, there had been very little in any country or at any time of self-conscious racial feeling. However much men of different races may have striven with one another, it was seldom in any sense of racial opposition that caused their strife. They fought for land. They plundered one another. They sought glory by conquest. They tried to force their religion on one another. But strong as patriotism and national feeling might be, they did not think of themselves in terms of ethnology. And in making war for every sort of reason, in none of such cases did the thought of racial distinctions come to the front. Now then, if this is true, where did our modern racial tension, race feeling, as Dr. Toynbee calls it, come from? It seems that its development came in civilized groups with the development of modern atheistic approaches to biology. Darwinism, for instance, suggests that different races represent different stages of evolutionary development and denies a meaningful or familial connection between all humans. The title of Darwin's most famous book is The Origin of the Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Although some modern Darwinists claim that he wasn't talking about human races, but was using it as a broad term for species, in his book, The Descent of Man, there's no room for debate. As he writes in the chapter on the affinities and genealogy of man, quote, "At some future period, not very distant as measured by centuries, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. At the same time, the anthropomorphous apes, as Professor Schaeffhausen has remarked, will no doubt be exterminated. The break between man and his nearest allies will then be wider, for it will intervene between man in a more civilized state, as we may hope, than even the Caucasian and some ape as low as the baboon, instead of now as between the Negro or Australian and the gorilla." Darwinism can be conclusively identified as the foundation and principle of the views of Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, and Adolf Hitler as well. But where human philosophies leave confusion, the Bible offers clarity. The scripture teaches that all living creatures of land, sea, and sky are divided up into kinds, according to Genesis 1, 21, 24, and 25. Kinds are defined in these passages as animals that can reproduce fertile offspring, or living things that can reproduce fertile offspring, which would mean all humans are of one kind, because all humans, no matter how different we look, can intermarry and reproduce fertile offspring. Of course, the Bible also teaches that the entire human race came from one original pair, Adam, the first man, according to 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 45, and Eve, the mother of all living, according to Genesis 3 and verse 20, and that through them, all are biologically related. Now then, the question, if all mankind came from one original human pair, how do we account for the vast ethnic diversity we've previously noticed? First of all, research has shown in many instances the success of a population's survival has been aided by genetic variability. While evolutionists equate this with chance processes operating in the sphere of survival of the fittest, creationists see it as just one more example of God's beneficent design. He has given us such variability, genetically speaking, so that we can successfully adapt as the need arises. For example, as we mentioned, the Oriental has the double fold of fat producing the almond eye shape. One benefit of this amazing doubly insulated eye would be to provide warmth in cold, snowy winters and in protecting the eye from snow-reflected UV light. It may be that all the physical features have developed this way, some for reasons we simply do not understand. But what about the rainbow of human skin color? How do we account for this coming from a single human pair in the short span of a few thousand years that the Bible record gives? Skin color is caused by the brown pigment in the skin called melanin. The more melanin a person has, the darker their skin will be as an adult, and the less melanin, the lighter their skin will be. An albino person has no melanin, and their pinkish white color is caused by their blood vessels showing through their colorless skin. So this difference in color, seemingly the most meaningful division of what we call race, is really just a matter of how much melanin we have in our skin. Doesn't mean so much when you look at it that way, does it? In humans, production of melanin is controlled by two pairs of genes, and we can designate them a little a, and capital B, little b. The capital letters represent dominant genes, and the small letters, recessive genes. Now, capital A and capital B being dominant produce melanin very well. Little a and little b being recessive produce melanin to a lesser degree. Gary Parker, in his book Creation, The Facts of Life, has observed that if Adam and Eve were both capital A, capital B, couldn't think of a better way to say this, they could have produced only children with the darkest coloration possible, and they themselves likewise would have been dark. That barring genetic mutations would have produced a world composed only of dark-skinned people. But as has been noted already, the Negroid race composes less than 10% of the world's population, so that can be ruled out. If Adam and Eve had been both little a, little b, then they could have only had children that were little a, little b, the lightest coloration possible, and the world would contain no other groupings. But it does. So that option can be ruled out. So is there any way that Adam and Eve could have produced all the modern variations of man? Yes, if Adam and Eve had been heterozygous. They'd had a big A and a little a and a big B and a little b, two dominant and two recessive genes. They would have been middle brown in color, and from them, in one generation, racial differences could have occurred quite easily. This chart expresses the genetic possibilities that could result if Adam and Eve had been heterozygous. Note that in a single generation, one could expect, theoretically, these colorations to be produced. One darkest, four dark, six medium, four light, and one lightest. A person born capital A, capital B, carries genes from the darkest coloration possible, and since all genes are dominant, has no genes for lightness. And if that person married another person who likewise was all dominant and moved into an area where intermarriage with people of different colors occurred, then offspring resulting from these marriages would carry the same dominant genes. These offspring would have lost the ability to be white, Conversely, if a person had all recessive, they would be the lightest possible. If they married another person who likewise carries all recessive and moves to an area where no intermarriage occurs, then they would lose the possibility of being black or producing any black children. They no longer have the genes necessary to produce enough melanin for black color. So starting with any two parents who were heterozygous, middle brown in color, extreme racial colors from black to white and others in between could be produced in such a way that races would have permanently different colors. Of course, it also is possible to produce a middle brown race that would have a fixed middle brown color if the original middle brown parents produced offspring of either big A, little B, little B, or little A, big B, big B, and these offspring married only others within their color. Now here's the question. Is it likely that people of various colorations intermarried? The existence of so many colorations in the world is evidence that they did. And interestingly enough, even evolutionists agree on this point. Boyce Rensenberger says, race mixing has not only been a fact of human history, but is in this day of unprecedented global mobility taking place at a more rapid rate than ever. It is not far-fetched to envision a day when the entire complexion of major population centers will be different. Meanwhile, we can see such changes taking place before our eyes, for they are part of everyday reality. Dr. Francisco Ayala, of the University of California, has observed that if the process started out with a couple that had only a 6.7 heterozygosity, which is the average in modern humans, the different combinations possible would be 1 followed by 2,017 zeros before the couple would have one child identical to the other. As Parker observed, it's likely that Adam and Eve were heterozygous. Otherwise, their descendants would have lacked variation. So, you've got at least one possible scientific explanation for the many skin colors that accords with the biblical narrative. But the point we want to draw from this is that these physical differences do not mean different races. Race and racism is a misnomer. In fact, race is a myth. Modern biology affirms this, and the Bible, in its marvelous foreknowledge, agrees. Without carrying in preconceived ideas about humanity, we find that the Bible does not mention the idea of racism at all, because the biblical writers had no concept of various human races. Humanity is all of one kind. The divisions in the Bible of humanity are peoples and families and tribes, cultures and nations. In Acts chapter 17, verses 26 to 27, the Apostle Paul in his sermon on Mars Hill makes the case for one God and one human family. And he says, "He has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the earth, and has determined their preappointed times and the boundaries of their dwelling." One blood is more literally one forefather or one ancestor. And while this seems to be a strong denial of real racial divisions among mankind, some people have actually used this verse to try to teach biblically mandated segregation. John R. Rice, in his commentary on Acts, says, "This verse gives the reason why love of country and love of race is proper. He suggests that God's determining the boundaries of their dwellings has reference to the dispersion of the Tower of Babel, and claims that this is where the world was divided into races, leading him to these conclusions. Number one, God meant for different races to live in different areas. Number two, God has chosen certain races for certain purposes. And number three, efforts to mix races are not wise in marriage, religion, or government." Now, the problem with this interpretation is twofold. First of all, it ignores and in fact contradicts the original statement that all men are one family of one common ancestor in Adam. And second, it focuses only on God preappointing the boundaries, when the Bible also says He preappointed the times. Now, what does that mean? Considering the entire statement, the most reasonable explanation of this verse is that God has had providential control in the strength and longevity of the empires and kingdoms of the world. The Greeks to whom Paul was speaking trusted in their Greekness. And note that this was a national rather than a racial pride. They believed that they held their place in the world because of their own glorious enlightenment. And Paul is telling them that the Creator God who he serves has given them their power and he can take it away, as taught in Daniel 2 and verse 21 and 4 and verse 17. So this passage really has nothing to do with race differences except to deny them and to affirm that all mankind is of one. Now, Dr. Rice refers to the Tower of Babel, and it might be worth mentioning that the Tower of Babel was a time of divinely imposed division of man into nations to scatter across the earth. This division was worked by God confusing the languages of men, and some have suggested that he would have divided them up at this point into groups with similar characteristics. That's certainly possible. Some people have said that would have assisted them in identifying who else spoke the same language as them. But regardless, the Bible in the entirety of its message is, shall we say, aloof and unconcerned with the physical distinctions of humanity. And there is certainly never in any scripture the slightest indication that different color groups or any other physical group is more important than another or really different from another in any way in the eyes of God. Now, many people, including most all of the authors I read after, see race issues in the Jew-Gentile controversy that is presented throughout the Bible from the time that Abraham was separated and his seed in Isaac and Jacob called to be the chosen people for God. But let's notice a few things about what this really meant. Was it really a race issue? Did God consider the Jews a superior race? Not at all. First of all, the Jews were not chosen by God simply to be privileged or to alone be saved. They were chosen for a service of holiness and consecration in the process of bringing the Messiah into the world. And secondly, the election was made without any thought to the value or strength or wisdom or goodness of the Jewish people. In fact, it was made before their patriarch was even born, according to Romans 9 and verse 11. Throughout the history of the Old Testament dispensation, we find that although the Jews were God's chosen people, in this sense, God cared very much about the other people of the world, those who we call Gentiles, and he made provision for their salvation as well. He sent them prophets such as Jonah. He made provisions for their care in the law of Moses. They were to receive full consideration and love, to be treated as equals with the full privileges and blessings when they lived among the Israelites as strangers, according to Exodus 22, 21, 23, and verse 9, Leviticus 19, 34, and Deuteronomy 10, verses 18 and 19. When Israel formed as a nation and some of these strangers desired to become a part of them, the law made provision for their full acceptance by means of circumcision, and this made them Israelites. But even those who did not go this far were under the protection of Israelite law and could live among the Israelites if they followed certain moral guidelines, according to Leviticus 20 and verse 2 and 24:16, 17:8 through 14, 18:26, Exodus 20 and verse 10, and also 12 and verse 19. Many Gentiles came into the nation of Israel by this means, including Jethro, Rahab, Ruth, the Gibeonites, and others. Some, like Naaman, experienced divine healing, according to 2 Kings 5, 15 through 19. After the exile, a strong effort was made to make converts or proselytes. And this is important because the controversy between the Jews and Gentiles in the early church was not a racial controversy as it is often depicted. It is not racism. It was not that the Jews didn't believe that non-Jews could be saved. In fact, Cornelius, who we often call the first Gentile convert, was not the first ethnic non-Jew to be converted. There were Samaritans who were converted, and the Ethiopian nobleman in Acts chapter 8. The controversy was not racial, but interpreted in light of Galatians, it had to do with the question of what was necessary for salvation. The Judaizers believed that one had to become a full Jew. He had to be circumcised and he had to keep the law in order to be saved. Cornelius was uncircumcised. He was not a keeper of the dietary law and some of those other things. And that was the radical issue about his acceptance into the kingdom. Not a race matter, but a matter of the nature of the gospel. Even when the Jews called Gentiles dogs, as in Matthew 15:26, or equated being a Samaritan to having a demon, John 8 and verse 48. The reference was to their immoral lives and the unclean practices of the people rather than their physical characteristics. The same can be said of the Greek barbarian controversy, which Paul is likely addressing in Acts 17, 26 through 27, but he specifically addresses in Colossians 3, verses 9 through 11. The Greeks considered all who weren't Greek or Hellenistic to be barbarians. But being Greek, as we mentioned a moment ago, was not a racial concept at all. As Dr. Toynbee demonstrates with ancient literature, being Greek was about speaking Greek, not being a slave, and living a Greek lifestyle. Toynbee says that Greeks believed that any barbarian could become a Greek, and any Greek could become a barbarian. It was all in how you lived. Of course, that kind of bigotry, although not racism as we know it, was still condemned. It was wrong. It had no place in the Christian religion. As Canadian scholar David Bratston says in his article on racism in the early church, however, any article on attitudes to racism in the Christian church's foundational period would be necessarily short. There simply was none. And again, racism was absent in the earliest church and in the non-Christian society surrounding it. Christians and other subjects of the Roman Empire simply did not make distinctions based on race. In fact, mentions of a person's skin color are so rare as to be insignificant. For instance, the Christian Bartisanus in the early 3rd century Eastern Syria mentioned the fact that people come in different colors as an example of what everyone agreed was inconsequential. So then, the only real teaching we'll get from the scripture on the subject of racism will be generic lessons from biblical principles. Genesis 1, 26 through 27 teaches that God created man in his own image and likeness, and in doing so gave him great personal worth and value above the rest of creation. Verse 27 emphasizes that the image of God was present in both man and woman. In other words, the whole human race. Some claim that the image was lost in the fall. But although Paul uses a similar term to speak of godliness in the Christian over in Colossians 3 and verse 10, there is a sense in which all men today have the image of God, according to Genesis 9 and verse 6 and 1 Corinthians 11 verse 7. And this truth should have a drastic impact on how we esteem our fellow man. What is on the outside does not change what is on the inside. My white skin gives me no more and no less value than anyone else on earth. And what makes each human being precious in the sight of God is that each of us possesses an immortal soul. Although the controversies in the New Testament time did not have to do with race, but culture and religion, such statements as Peter's words in Acts 10, 34 and 35, when he said, "In truth, I perceive that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, whomever fears Him and works righteousness is accepted by Him," has a great lesson, and one that is often repeated in the New Testament writings. We make a great mistake. In fact, we commit a terrible sin when we draw borders on God's love and acceptance that He has not drawn. That's exactly what is happening when any Christian allows another person's skin color to affect the way we look at them or judge their worth or the fellowship and kindness we should extend to them or the hospitality we should show to them or whether we think they should have the gospel preached to them or whether they ought to be members of the church. Race is a myth. It is a false distinction, as false as the imaginary borders of the Greeks that they drew between their way of life and the rest of the world. Jesus commissioned that His kingdom be preached to all nations and every creature, certainly to allow bigotry and over physical characteristics to stand in the way of that is sinful and evil. The kingdom of Christ, where His disciples live, is characterized by men who love their neighbor as themselves, according to Matthew 22 and verse 39. And the parable of the Good Samaritan shows that tribes and nations, even religious differences, don't keep our fellow man from receiving that treatment. How much more would this apply to a distinction that, according to the Bible, isn't even real? But this is hard for us to accept and apply, isn't it? Because there's no such thing as race. How can that be? We use that term all the time. We talk and we hear about racism all the time. Well, I think it's true that racism is real, but race is not. It is an imbecilic idea. An imbecilic idea. It betrays a man's utter foolishness. Racists are, above all men, most ignorant. They build their life around a hatred towards something that isn't even real. Spending their lives in a furious battle over a false identity, not only is it foolish, but any hatred of your fellow man is evil and it will send a soul to hell, according to Galatians chapter 5, verses 20 and 21. And biblically, hatred can be defined as esteeming less. If you think a person is less important simply because they don't look like you, that's a sin, and that will take you to hell. So in our closing moments, let's think about ways this practically affects us. Now, slavery is not really a racial issue. And I'm not going to be able to talk about all the questions about slavery. But, you know, it existed thousands of years before race feelings were ever thought of. And among nations where people looked like each other, they enslaved one another. But in this nation, we live in the shadow of a time in history when black people were the primary slave population and white people were the primary slave owners. And that's caused some problems for us. The white portion of American society has had to fight and work to the understanding that black people are in no respect inferior to them. But as this has been happening, many black people have built themselves a proud racist identity that is no less sinful than that of white supremacy. And black Christians and white Christians must be sure that supremacist attitudes have no place in their hearts. For many years, there has been a strong aversion to intermarriage in several color groups in America, and attempts to intermarry were frowned upon by most all, but that does not have a biblical basis. If we're all of one, then we can all marry, and what really matters is if you marry a Christian. That's the important thing. One issue I was asked to address and feel should be addressed is that of stereotyping. Stereotyping is defined literally as to make a mold, but socially it speaks of making generalizations about a group of people and judging all on those generalizations. Now, my comments on this may not be popular. I hope I don't get tarred and feathered for them. But I'm endeavoring to give the most scriptural and practical answer, if not the most politically correct one. Stereotyping, in some ways, cannot be avoided. Folks, we're going to observe physical characteristics about people. We can't help that. It's impossible to not see color or not see what person's eyes look like. There's ways we identify people when we look at them. And you make judgments. You make judgments naturally in some way. Wherever there are cultures and societies also, there will be observable norms, some good and some bad. The Apostle Paul mentioned a negative stereotype about Cretans, that they were all lazy gluttons and evil beasts. This had originated from one of their own commentators. But the interesting thing is Paul says in verse 13, this testimony is true. He agreed with it, endorsed it. H.H. Harvey, commenting on this issue, says, doubtless there were many individual exceptions, but these characteristics belong to them as a nation. Now, how do we handle this? What's going on here? Is Paul a bigot? No, Paul's purpose in mentioning this was that Titus would know what issues he needed to address in his preaching and evangelism. What does it mean to us? It means that while we should never be ignorantly broad in our characterizations of people, we shouldn't say that somebody is lazy just because we met a lazy person who looked like him or her many years ago. And that's foolish. That's ridiculous. On the other hand, we should not be so politically correct that we are blind to real tendencies in a cultural group, especially if it's our cultural group. And these, if they're wrong, should be rebuked sharply, just like in the days of Crete. If there is a custom among black people or white people or any color of people that is immoral or unscriptural, it doesn't matter if it's just what white people do or if it's just what black people do. It needs to be condemned because we're more than black or white. We're Christians. And that's the highest level of behavior and activity that should concern us. Also, we must not be overly sensitive. And this is important in this nation, where people are coming out of a time when racial thought has had a very devastating effect 50 years ago, 100 years ago, and earlier. There may be people who say something they're not thinking about what it sounds like. We need to be long-suffering. We need to be patient and realize that maybe they don't mean a personal attack against us. We should not act as if making insensitive comments is the unpardonable sin. Many Christians do it innocently without realizing that their words were offensive, although we ought to be careful. We ought to be thoughtful and we ought to be prudent. Sometimes it may be found that genuine bigotry lies at the back of a statement and then it must be dealt with. Now that brings us to the difficult question, what should a congregation do when there is a racist in the church? Racism is, after all, an attitude and it can be manifested in various ways. Here's a few. Shunning a person socially or refusing to extend fellowship to them, asking them to leave the church service, making them feel unwanted or unwelcome, calling them racially derogatory slurs either to their face or behind their backs to other members, or even being known around town as such a fella, insinuating or suggesting through public or private teaching that one group of people is worth less than another or anything like that. These actions are manifestations of a sinful attitude and they are subject to church discipline as any other sinful behavior. But what if a man has voiced his racism and no doubt about it, but he really doesn't make much of an issue of it. He isn't a leader. Or if he is a leader, he keeps quiet about that stuff at least. What then? Well, I think about one of the reasons for withdrawal mentioned in 1 Corinthians 5 is covetousness. You know, covetousness is an attitude, it's a disposition that manifests itself in many ways, but it will always manifest itself somehow. And if you find a covetous man and he does something one time, he says, oh, I'll never do that again, you still have to deal with him because his heart has to change or else it'll rise up again. It'll rise up again in some destructive way. An evil tree bears bad fruit, as Brother Smith said the other day. If the attitude is known, that means it has been manifest before and it must be opposed, it must be dealt with. When repentance is made, we must remember that as terrible a sin as racism is, Jesus saves and Jesus forgives. I was visiting with a preacher the other day and he told me about going to a congregation in the southern United States, and it was mentioned there that they encouraged, or I should say discouraged, black people from attending their services. He got up and he preached a sermon, a very hard, strong, angry sermon against that activity. And the people asked him to come back and hold them another meeting. And he said no. He said that he hated those people, that he didn't want to have anything to do with them. He was so disgusted and so appalled that anyone like that could be in the church. Well, folks, they are wrong. They're wrong. But we need to save them too. We need to preach to them too. It's just as wrong for us to hate them as it's wrong for them to hate somebody else. We need to be long-suffering and we need to be evangelistic to all people. I will say I do fear for a great deal of people because of this issue. Some of my brethren, some of my sisters in the church, preachers, elders, old saintly women, by most accounts. And I look at this, I think about it. I wish I could just roll on. I wish I could just stick my head in the sand and ignore it, but it's there. And without opposition and preaching of the truth, it will not go away. That's my lesson.